getting a fair shake. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, a conversation about fairness in our local criminal justice system as we welcome State Attorney Melissa Nelson. You can join us. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, the City of Jax is looking to build resiliency in an era of warming oceans and bigger storms. We'll tell you about that later on. But first this hour, a new report says race and ethnicity aren't big factors in cases handled by State Attorney Melissa Nelson. The new study out of Florida International University and Loyola University looked at this region's prosecutorial effectiveness and fairness, and in particular, whether the race or ethnicity of the defendants played a role in their convictions. There's a lot to get into. So right now, we're pleased to welcome State Attorney Melissa Nelson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Also here in studio, lead FIU researcher Basiki Kutataladze. He's an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Florida International University and one of the study's authors. That's a mouthful. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Okay, here's our question to callers as we speak with State Attorney Melissa Nelson and the lead researcher. How fair do you think our local criminal justice system is? What are your questions about this new report? Give us a call, 549-2937. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. State Attorney Nelson, let's begin with you. Why was this circuit, North Florida, Clay, Duval, and Nassau counties, chosen to be studied on this matter?
A couple of years ago, after I took office, we had the opportunity to essentially pitch for this opportunity. We're one of four district attorneys, prosecutors' offices across the United States that was chosen to participate in this study and partner with Florida International University. So we were excited to have the opportunity to work with this research group. This is a second part of a much broader project, and certainly, while pleased with the results of part two, really we think the most important thing for the community to know is the process itself, the mm-hmm. willingness of our office to both examine ourselves and our decision making and be self-critical, identify areas where we can improve and take steps to do just that.
549-2937 to connect with State Attorney Melissa Nelson. Okay, Professor K, I'm going to shorten your name now so I don't mangle it in any more ways. Tell me about the study. How did you look at this circuit and how did you study the role of race and ethnicity in arrests and convictions? How did it all work?
Sure. So we got data for 2 years for all felonies and misdemeanors disposed of by the state attorney's office in 2017 and 2018. So we're talking about 80,000 plus cases here. And we looked into the treatment of Black, Hispanic, and white defendants. We also had some data for Asians, but unfortunately numbers are not large enough to do the kind of statistical analysis that we needed to implement. So we compared the outcomes for this different racial groups or ethnic groups across five decision points. One, whether the case was filed or not. Then if the case was filed, what happened to the charges? Arrest charges were the same or were reduced or increased at case filing. Then once the case was filed, what happens next? Was the case dismissed? Was the case diverted? Was the case disposed of through guilty pleas or trials? And what happens also charges from filing to the case disposition. There is some plea bargaining going on there, obviously. And ultimately, we also looked into the sentencing, whether defendants received custodial or non-custodial sentences while accounting for the host of other factors. Like, for example, for sentencing analysis, we considered the influence of 26 legal and non-legal factors. For example, we know that you can compare two defendants if they have different charges or they have different prior record. Therefore, we statistically accounted for those factors in addition to the defense counsel type and age and victim's characteristics to mm-hmm. compare apples to apples.
So What's interesting is to note your findings show that cases were actually slightly more likely to be dismissed if the person was African American. Why is that? Is that right?
Yes, that
yeah.
is correct.
And why is that?
So the question why is the good thing about this study and the statistical analysis is that it has posed questions. And one of those questions you've just identified is why? We can speculate, this is not based in data yet, but we're going to drill down on this. I suspect the majority of person crimes committed by African Americans are committed against African Americans, against African American victims. I suspect, and we're going to look at this, that the dismissal rate is a result of the lack of witness cooperation that we face every single day. People either afraid to come forward or distrustful of the system, victim reluctance or reticence. And if we, in fact, are able to identify that that might be a reason for this issue, then it's something that we at the state attorney's office can address. Every day, we're trying to continue to build trust in the community and confidence in the work we do. If my speculative thought is correct, then it will be an area that we can focus some efforts and resources.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Attorney Melissa Nelson and a lead researcher on a new study showing that race and ethnicity don't play a big role in convictions and prosecutions in our North Florida Judicial Circuit. What's your reaction to that? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Professor Kay, this result, this data may seem counterintuitive to people who perceive that the criminal justice system, by and large across the country, is rigged or biased against people of color. What's your response to that?
That will be a reasonable sort of reaction, and I do expect that. I mean, if we look nationally, only 13% of the U.S. population are Black or African American. Yet we look into the prisons, we have nearly 38% of prison inmates are Black. Of course, there are racial disparities in the system. If we look from that perspective, African Americans and Hispanics are much more likely to be incarcerated. But in this particular study, we are looking at the cases as they're brought to the office. What prosecutors do to exacerbate or reduce those possible disparities. And from that point, I'm always asked to summarize these findings in one or two sentences, and it's very, very hard because the findings really vary by decision point and offense type. But overall, you are absolutely right, Melissa, that at that point, obviously legal characteristics of the case, such as charge severity, mm-hmm. prior record, or defendant's age, or defense counsel type, play a much bigger role than race of a defendant.
State Attorney Nelson, you were elected on a mandate to really change the focus of the state attorney's office. Your predecessor had come under heavy criticism for she was perceived as overly punitive. Is your leadership playing a part in the way this data is shaking out? Because you've employed more of what's known as a smart justice approach.
I don't think we have changed the way the office and the prosecutors in the office make decisions. They make the decisions on the files in front of them based on the facts and the evidence in front of them. I believed that to be true before we engaged in this study. It's confirmed by this data. But I made promises when I ran that included that we would be, as an office, transparent. I think participation in this study and the public distribution of this data and the findings speaks to that. And I promised we would be accountable. And where we have identified areas that we can improve, and we have through this study, then we'll be accountable to that as well. And we also promised that we would bring, it's important that people trust the system actors. In order for us to be successful in our work, people have to trust and have confidence in the work that we're doing. And so bringing fairness and equity to the work we do is also a priority. And I think this study hits on all three of those points, that just the participation in it, and obviously the public distribution of this information is important.
Let's go to your calls now for State Attorney Melissa Nelson and lead FIU researcher Professor Kay about this new study looking at just how fair is the criminal justice system here in our area. particularly examining cases through the lens of race and ethnicity. What are your thoughts and comments? 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First, I want to say I thank the leaders in Florida, you know, for making this a priority in their tenure. However, I'm former law enforcement. I was a former prosecutor, and I'm currently a lawyer in Jacksonville, and I have been for over a decade. And I can tell you that although I haven't looked at the study, I will. I'm sure that there are what we call third confounding variables, because I can tell you for a fact, and I think any minority would agree with me, you know, that the findings in that study, however they are presented, are deeply flawed. So I will give you a specific example, and this was from my experience as a prosecutor. You know, during the process of voir dire, where you pick the jury, most prosecutors understand, and some like me, were inappropriately and illegally directed to only pick elderly white men, because the saying is white men convict. That's just a small example of why the system is flawed, and it's at a systemic, you know, foundational basis. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, let's talk about that. Professor Kay, I think she's giving voice to the skepticism some have about the study, that the data might not necessarily tease out systemic racism. And what about that particular example she noted, that a prosecutor can put on the jury whoever they like and choose by race? That's one example that she pointed out.
I think nationally, the research suggests that that's a problem. And while our study didn't look into that particular issue here, we simply don't have the data about the jury selection, it's possible that it's a problem here. So it doesn't go against what we are reporting here. But the fact that more than 90% of cases are disposed of through guilty pleas, these numbers that presented in this report will not be any different. I don't expect that would be drastically different, even if we consider that result.
Let me ask you as well, as State Attorney Nelson, this study only looked at cases that went before your prosecutors. It didn't look at arrests.
That's correct.
What about that factor?
So this study focused, as you've mentioned, on just the five decision points that prosecutors make through on the decision spectrum. If I can go back for one moment as to the caller's point, I want to be clear that we are not saying at all, as a result of the findings as it relates to prosecutorial decision making and race not being an influential factor in those, that we're not saying that there are not racial disparities in the criminal justice system. We recognize there are. That gave rise to, obviously, part of this study. I will say, in picking jurors, selecting jurors, and every Monday our lawyers do, it is against the law for us to choose jurors based on their race or to exclude jurors based on their race. And there is no directive in my office mm-hmm. at all from anyone to choose jurors based on race. So to your question about not looking at arrests, this study does not look at arrests. It focuses only on the prosecutor's decision making. Obviously, that there might be opportunity to do that, but that is not data that our office actually is in control of.
Art is in Mandarin. Hi, Art. Good morning to you. Go ahead, Art. You're on the air.
You mean Mark or Art?
Okay, they told me your name's Art. Is that wrong?
Okay, this is Mark.
Oh, Mark. Hi, Mark.
Professor Kay said that we also looked at Asians, but unfortunately there was insufficient data. I just think that when there's a demographic group where there are too few people committing felonies, we should say, fortunately, there was insufficient data.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks for that. But you did look, you looked at every demographic group in this community, right? And also you did a similar study. You looked at four different state attorneys' offices, Chicago, Milwaukee, Tampa, and Jacksonville.
That's correct.
Okay, so how do we compare to those other cities?
Oh, we stay away from the comparisons.
No, come on.
We have done. You know, there are more than 2,300 prosecutorial local prosecutorial offices in this country, and probably around 10 of them have committed to this kind of transparency. You know, while this is the partnership with Melissa's office, you know, we maintain complete and absolute independence. We have said where disparities were big or small in other jurisdictions. So I think comparing Chicago to Milwaukee or to Jacksonville will not be fair. We have those findings that we have not released yet. And perhaps we can have that conversation later this year.
You're releasing more findings later this year. And what will those be focused on?
That will be the same on race for other jurisdictions. And then we have this third phase of the project. You know, there are areas, as Melissa mentioned, that require additional attention, whether it's a diversion or plea offers, et cetera. So we're putting in place prosecutorial performance indicators to stay on top of those findings and see how findings vary over time as we're implementing reforms and thinking about these decisions long term. Because you cannot just have this kind of one study and abandon it. We have to track change on a monthly and quarterly or yearly basis. And Melissa is really committed to putting this data in public and seeing how these numbers evolve from one year to another.
Here's an email from Gabriel. Thank you for this segment. Please don't just refer to your guest as Professor K. You're dehumanizing him on the radio. We foreigners would prefer that people mispronounce our names than not even make an effort at all. That's Gabriel emailing us from Live Oak Cardiology, Gabriel Mufuka, MD. Gabriel, thank you for pointing that out. He is lead FIU researcher, Vasiki Kutataladze.
That's incredible.
And
thank
I
you.
Didn't. The reason I referred to him as Professor K is I just didn't want to get his name wrong. But I really appreciate that feedback because we do want to be sensitive to making sure we honor people's identities and names. Here's an email from Ricardo. Can you ask again about arrest rates by race? Prosecution may not be biased, but can they back out to the bigger picture of criminal justice? Melissa Nelson, what about that? Certainly, there are a wealth of other studies out there to show that if you're a person of color, you are more likely to be, you know, arrested during a traffic stop by police and a lot of other scenarios.
So we had a conversation yesterday, a dialogue about arrests. And while I don't have that data in front of me and can't speak to any statistical analysis about it, obviously, the areas we in our city are struggling and challenged with a very significant violent crime problem. Our law enforcement partners, Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, as well as the State Attorney's Office, has spent a lot of thought and deliberation in trying to be very strategic about how we address that problem. Naturally, the areas, the zones, and the geographic areas in our city that are suffering the most violence are going to naturally have the greatest amount of police presence. Because of that presence, making sure that the police are on the ground and available to immediately respond to shots fired and 911 calls, does that police presence, that higher police presence, relay in higher arrests? I suspect it does, although I don't know that, but I think that just makes sense. And so we have to consider in having this conversation, I suspect we want our law enforcement officers in the areas that are plagued by the violence. I think that makes sense. I think everybody would agree with that. I think, unfortunately, probably as a result of that, you see greater arrest rates in those same geographic areas.
It is certainly a pressing issue for law enforcement in your office. We're on pace to top last year's murder rate already this year. And off and on, we've been the murder capital of Florida for the better part of 20 years. Can you share a little bit more your thoughts about how you work with law enforcement on this? Because it's a massive public safety issue for us.
Melissa, it is. And while I'm very happy to be here and discussing this work that we've been engaged in over the last 2 years, our greatest priority in our office as well is using the tools available to us as prosecutors to address the challenges of violent crime. Every single day, our prosecutors are sitting down with mothers and fathers who have lost children to gun violence. And so we've tried to, I always say, we open a file and address something after something bad has already happened. So we're trying to be more thoughtful in how we can engage in the other legs of the stool, which is prevention and intervention. What tools do we have at the state attorney's office? What partnerships can we create? That, as you've seen, has resulted in bringing NIBIN technology with the blessing of the city who funded it, NIBIN Technology, and the Crime Gun Intelligence Center. And they are, our prosecutors are embedded with our law enforcement partners and meeting weekly to discuss the intelligence that's coming from that. And I'll tell you right now, we're overwhelmed with information. I can also tell you, although we are certainly very sensitive to the fact that the homicide numbers, we're watching those every single day, we are seeing success as well with those innovative technologies. It is a priority of our office.
John is in Avondale. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I just have a question for Ms. Nelson. She said there was no directive about choosing a juror by race. And if you want to be fair, let's just say you're a prosecutor and you want to be fair, or you were a defense attorney, and you notice that the jury selection is becoming all white and the defendant is a person of color, and you want to be fair, and you choose someone of color to be on the jury, you are in fact choosing someone for the jury because of race. So, and it's a curiosity, and I'm just wondering if maybe juries should be selected by lot or something to take it, to take that element out of it. Yeah, just a thought. Mm.
Thanks, John. Yeah. Okay. What about that?
So that's an interesting question, except that we would not be able to do it by lot, because one of the things that the whole purpose of voir dire is to assess if people come, everybody comes to the courtroom with a set of personal experiences and perspectives. And it's important for both the state and the defense to vet those, any potential biases or any potential personal experiences that might make a person inappropriate for a particular case. I'm watching our trials and going in our courtrooms, and I'm looking at the makeup of our jurors. And I can tell you, in watching voir dire, I believe our jurors are being selected on their appropriateness for a case.
It's interesting when, for example, they have auditions for a community orchestra, for example, they'll do a blind audition because studies have found that they're more likely to choose a white male than, say, an African-American female. But then when they put them behind a screen and they sound exactly the same, they're chosen solely on their ability because the judges can't see the race or gender of the person doing the audition. So it's interesting to hear this conversation because, of course, the famous expression is that justice is blind.
Mm-hmm.
But how can justice truly be blind as you said, everyone brings their lived experience to the process? It's difficult to achieve that, isn't it?
Certainly, it's, I think, difficult to be blind because not only the folks who come to a courtroom and are potential jurors, but the lawyers in the courtroom, the court staff, all of us have a set of personal experiences that we bring to any particular decision that we make. But I think a study like this, this process, the purpose of it was to ferret out and determine if, at least as it relates to prosecutors, if any potential biases were rearing its head in our decision making. And fortunately, we found that it is not across 11 different outcomes, with the exception of the one that you mentioned.
So with all of that said, you're having a panel discussion about this tonight. Tell us about it.
We did it last night.
Oh, it was last night. Pardon me.
Will you,
it was last night. Yes. So how did that go?
I think it went pretty well. It was, we had around 60 community members that came to express all kinds of concerns, views, support for this work. And this is exactly what we wanted. We wanted to hear from them. We want to hear from them their views and critical views, especially about this kind of work. And understand also that we are fully transparent about this process. You know, as I said, you know, while this is a partnership, Melissa's office does not have any control what went into the report beyond Melissa's forward. And also, we are pretty open with the data. We are open to the phone calls or conversations as part of that group, as well as outside. We had multiple people that followed up with us with questions. I think the whole point of that is to have the conversation, because racial disparity is a big problem and it's not going to be resolved by one study or by one conversation. But the more honest we are and about the challenges, the more likely we are to find the solutions. And I'll give you an example Melissa was mentioning earlier about, you know, racial disparities exist in the system, but also they disadvantage the victims. I'll give you the, you know, I did the work in New York City where, you know, African-American women are 10 times more likely to be the victims of domestic violence homicide. So, you know, it really cuts both ways. But while thinking about the victim, we cannot forget that, you know, some communities, as you were mentioning earlier, are more policed, and especially people for low-level offenses accumulate very lengthy prior record that subsequently really damages their chances to deal with other cases, non-related cases. And something that I'm struggling myself, what should prosecutors do if somebody has 10 prior arrests and is perfectly aware that the person comes from the minority neighborhoods that are heavily policed? What can prosecutors do? Can they just completely be blind to that fact? I really don't think that prosecutors can individually make those decisions. There has to be some kind of policy, some kind of legal intervention there if, as a society, we want to do something about this.
Okay.
We give them the laws and we want them to follow those laws. And I think it will be unfair for prosecutors to change that on any given case.
One more question for you. This is off topic, what you came here to talk today about, Melissa, but here's a tweet from a listener. We'd like to know her position on the decriminalization of marijuana, as other state attorneys have started to refuse those cases. Do you have a stance on that?
Sure. My job, I'm not a legislator. I'm not a lawmaker. I'm in the executive branch of the government, and I am actually charged with prosecuting criminal violations of our state laws. And I will continue to prosecute cases that are on our books. Now, I will tell you the way we deal with possession of misdemeanor marijuana, and I don't know if the public appreciates this, but we do not, our pretrial detention facility is not filled with people we are prosecuting heavily or heavy-handed for possession of marijuana. Most of those cases, in fact, are diverted. Sometimes those charges are attendant to a series of other charges, but I, in my role and charged with what I am, will continue to follow the law.
All right. Thanks for that. And thank you, State Attorney Melissa Nelson. Also with us today, lead FIU researcher Bisiki Kutataladze, Associate Professor of Criminology, Criminal Justice at Florida International University. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Well, today, of course, is September 11th. It's the 18th anniversary of that terrible day since terrorists commandeered airplanes to take aim at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. This morning at Ground Zero in Manhattan, there was a memorial to honor the nearly 3,000 people who lost their lives 18 years ago today. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, Dorian thankfully spared this region, but hurricane season is going till November 1st. We still need to be vigilant and prepare for the possibility of another big storm. With some important information now, we welcome Chris Ryan, Project Manager, and Pauline Gary, Director of Marketing and Business Development for ServPro of JAX. Good morning to you both.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having us.
You know, whenever there's a big storm, ServPro swings into action, particularly to remove water. So, Chris, let's begin with you. Luckily, we were spared the worst of Dorian in this area, but you're on guard for another big storm. What do you want people to know?
The big thing is to be prepared. You know, don't wait till the last second to get your preparations in order. It's very important, you know, before the storm comes, know your evacuation zones. You know where you need to go if, in fact, you do need to evacuate. It's also very important that you have your ready kits.
Have your disaster kit
exactly,
ready to go.
Exactly. And that's a big thing is, you know, like I said, you don't want to wait till the last second to be prepared for something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, we see that every storm, Pauline, people kind of running out at the last minute to buy water and it's all sold out, or to buy a generator and they're all sold out. We saw that again with Dorian. What about after the storm? What are some ideas for after the storm?
Yeah, it's really important just to make sure that you know who your team is going to be after the storm, just to, if in fact your family or your business needs help. So we just really recommend that you've got all your insurance information together, you've got your personal family contacts together and in order, and also just know who is the team you're going to call. If in fact you have water intrusion in your home, who are you going to reach out to? And that's really important to have that on hand.
People underestimate how much damage water can cause, and many people don't have flood insurance. Flood insurance can pay for a service like yours,
correct.
Right?
Yep, that's correct.
It can't be said often enough that you need to be prepared for this.
Exactly.
Because the whole darn state is practically a flood zone these days.
Yes, ma'am, that's exactly right. And there's things that you can do to help prepare your home to prevent additional losses to your home. It's very important to get any kind of electronics, any kind of furniture, you want to raise that off of the floor, whether you're using 2x4s or some kind of blocking system that's going to get your personal effects off the floors. It's also very important to go through your home and take pictures of all your items. Or nowadays, you can go through and you can take videos with your phones, and it makes it a lot easier to, if you do have issues down there, you know, if you do have flooding or if you do have water damage, to be able to look back on that and help with the inventory, with your insurance or anything.
Sure. So. Now, there are several more named storms brewing out there right now, Pauline. We've got to keep our fingers crossed that
Absolutely.
They stay far away from us.
That's right. That's right. We, you know, we're really thrilled as a top 100 franchise in the nation out of 1,800. We have a team on standby 24/7. So, you know, just keep tuning in and watching, certainly listening to First Coast Connect. You guys were a partner of the Florida Radio Emergency Prepared Network
right.
with WJCT. Also, take a look at our Facebook page. That would be, you know, really a place to start, just to make sure you're in touch with what's happening real time.
That's right. So thank you both for being here. Chris Ryan and Pauline Gary, both with ServPro of JAX. You can find them online too, ServProJacksonvilleSouth.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. Yeah, you guys can take off. Yeah.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, this Friday, the City of Jacksonville is holding its annual environmental symposium in collaboration with UNF. The theme, Building Resiliency. In the wake of Hurricane Dorian and a changing climate and the flooding this city endured in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, this is more timely and urgent than ever. James Richardson heads up the city's Environmental Protection Board and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so the theme of this symposium is building resiliency, inspiring, informing, and engaging our community. This is a critical issue for Jacksonville, becoming a more resilient city. What's on tap for this symposium?
Well, we have lots of good information and good connections, good opportunities for people to learn what's happening. The focus this year being on resiliency took a look at the storms the past couple of years and wanted to shift and hopefully raise the awareness of how we can prepare for storms and how we can recover from them. So we have Jim Murley. He's the chief resiliency officer in Miami-Dade coming up to give one of our keynote addresses. We have Whitney Gray, who heads the Florida Coastline Resilience Program with DEP. They're going to share insights on what's happening across the state. And then we have Corps of Engineers, a number of consultants and others focusing on what's being done locally to help prepare the city for future storms.
And it's good to see that there's action happening on this. There have also been a couple of committees, a working group on flooding that was state mandated, a resiliency committee looking at resiliency issues for Jacksonville.
Yes.
And of course, you've led on this issue for years with the Environmental Protection Board. What would you say to critics of Jacksonville's leadership over the years that we've been slow to get proactive on resiliency? As one example, Miami-Dade County, as you mentioned, has a chief resiliency officer. A lot of other Florida cities do, too. Even the state has one now. Do we need a position like that in Jacksonville and a more dedicated long-term focus?
I think the two committees that were formed, one under the auspices of the mayor and one, as you said, was kind of more state mandated, both took a look at what can be done. I think there's some call for looking at Jacksonville having an established position. It could happen. I think it's likely, more likely to happen at some point than not. But I think it's very important to know that regardless of what's happened in the past, the city, I think, now is really taking the opportunity to focus on the effort and try to be a little bit more proactive than perhaps it has been in the past. So,
how urgent is this for your office? A recent study looked at the cost of hardening cities to rising waters. Jacksonville, according to a New York Times report, turns out we're the most expensive city in America if we wanted to put up seawalls, because we have so much coastline, both on the river and on the ocean. It would be in the billions and billions of dollars. How can the city possibly get prepared for this future? It's going to be incredibly expensive, whether we do that or not. These resiliency measures are a lot of money, but the argument is if you don't do it, it's going to cost you a lot more, right?
That is true. That is true. I think what we're going to see being done now is taking some money and dedicating it to do a good assessment of where we are and build a foundation from there. It's going to take a lot of capital investment, I think, to harden the city to the extent that it may be necessary. But we need to really first establish a baseline, determine where we are, look at our most vulnerable spots and where to direct that funding.
And where are the biggest vulnerabilities that you've identified?
I don't know that it's been identified. One of the two committees that has been working is authorized a study. I know JEA is in the process of conducting one for their assets now. The city of Jacksonville will do the same kind of thing. We'll have consultant come in and do that assessment. We've got a lot of water. We've got the river as well as a number of tributaries. Obviously, those are the first places that you would think would be more vulnerable. We need to look at where critical infrastructure is located, how close it is to some of those tributaries. Those are the kinds of things that we'll be looking at.
Okay. As all of this is happening later this month, the entire world will be holding climate actions on September 20th, climate strikes. School children all over the world are striking for the climate, begging adults to address this issue in a meaningful way. Will that aspect of this come up at the symposium, how carbon emissions are driving climate change, driving warmer oceans, rising waters, stronger storms, and how that is uniquely giving Florida a vulnerability that is of growing concern?
The unique city, the unique opportunity for me to coordinate allows me to see a number of the presentations. I don't know that they're going to focus on that, however. I have not seen the presentations. I think the opportunity, some of the speakers will take advantage of that. One, Jeremy Stalker is going to talk about the science of climate change, so it's likely to come up there. This year, for the first time, we have a youth session. So some of the things that the high school and middle school students are doing, it may come up there. So we'll see. For those who were lucky enough to purchase tickets, they'll get to see all of this. Unfortunately, the event is sold out.
Sold
now.
Out. It's a hot ticket.
So, yeah, it's a very hot ticket. So prepare for next year. I will. We are having a Thursday event with the Green Building Council the evening before from 6 to 9 at the DuPont Center, which is free to the public, Building Community Resiliency. Jim Murley from Miami, as well as some others, are going to be there and discuss a lot of the same topics. So you can find that at the Green Building Council's Facebook page or the Environmental Protection Board's Facebook page to get information on how people can come to that.
Okay, so a big event Thursday night at the downtown Jesse Ball DuPont Center, and then on Friday, the city's environmental symposium with UNF is sold out. The theme is building resiliency, inspiring, informing, and engaging our community. It may be a little late in coming, according to some critics out there, but the community is now very much engaged, James, it seems, on this issue, which is a good thing.
It is. It is. And you know, we can only build and improve upon things. So I think we're going to do good.
Okay. Well, we so thank you for your leadership on this and for stopping by. It's good to hear that sold out. It's a very frightening and challenging topic, but at least people are now really dialed into this. Let me take a moment too to plug our effort at WJCT to cover these issues of resiliency, mitigation, adaptation. A shameless plug for our digital magazine, adaptflorida.org, adaptflorida.org, where we took a deep dive into these issues and we'll continue to update there. James Richardson, the City of Jack's Environmental Protection Board Administrator.
Yes,
that's the right title, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is. Always good to see you. Thank you. And in a moment, two big milestones to mark. First, the Ritz Theater marks 20 years. That's coming up. Plus, fall fun at Congaree and Penn. Stay with us.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Times Union Media and J Magazine will be hosting a J Event panel discussion on September 24th at the River Club. Guests will enjoy lunch while networking with downtown's most prominent advocates. TimesUnionMedia.com/events for more information.
on the next Fresh Air, Tan France, the fashion expert on the Netflix series Queer Eye. When the show won an Emmy, he told the Academy, "I never expected a Pakistani boy would be winning an Emmy for being on a show about being openly gay." He was raised in a traditional Muslim family in England. His husband was raised in a Mormon family on a ranch in Utah. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Next time on The World, what we've forgotten about 9/11, a morning when no one knew what was going on.
Well into the afternoon, we were worried about other hijacked planes, that there were sort of more attacks coming the next day, the next month.
Author Garrett Graff pulls together first-person accounts that relive September 11th in the moment. Those stories on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
What did President George W. Bush do in the hours after the 9/11 terror attacks? Historian Garrett Graff tells that story using new transcripts and recently declassified documents. It's a detailed account of the 8 hours spent flying above America with three F-16s for company. The only plane in the sky. Next time on 1A. Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Fall is in the air, and that means there's a lot going on at Congaree and Penn Farm. You got to get out there and enjoy it. Founder Scott Meyer is here now to tell us all about everything from the pumpkin patch to other fall celebrations. Hey, Scott, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. So you have a farm day coming up September 28th and then the pumpkin patch. That's so exciting.
Yeah, we're kind of getting excited about fall. I mean, it's still a little bit hot out here in Jacksonville, but we're getting excited. We've got a lot going on the 28th. We've got Bee Friends Farm out doing some pollination workshops. We've got Art Darling, which is something new. We've partnered with them, and Bethany is going to be doing some really cool stuff at the farm this fall. Starting on the 28th, there'll be a kids' nature walk and art experience, and it's going to be really a lot of fun. And then we'll have Nick Zimmer back out doing both cheese making and a succulent workshop, which we're looking forward to.
Oh, it is such a fun experience. I've had the opportunity to come out, and I really recommend this. Go on out to Congaree and Penn for all of this. And by the way, you have a wildly popular dinner series called 20 at the Farm. That sells out fast.
It does. And it's sold out for October already, but on October 1st, the tickets will be out for the month of November. So you better check it out, 9 a.m. on October the 1st.
Okay. Now, families love coming out to the pumpkin patch. What do they need to know to plan a trip this fall season?
Sure. So this year, we're actually expanding the patch throughout the month of October. But we do ask that you go and register online. It's available now on our website. That way, we can kind of keep the crowds less overwhelming and have it be a better experience for everybody.
All right. Just go to Congaree and Penn. Get out and enjoy Congaree and Penn Farm at congareeandpenn.com. You will not regret it. It is such a blast, a beautiful place just outside the city, and all the city stress just melts away. It's wonderful. So Scott Meyer, thanks for driving into town to share this with us, and enjoy the fall.
Thank you.
Okay, finally this hour, we want to make note of something. Jacksonville's downtown jewel, the Ritz Theater, is celebrating 20 years of entertainment and education this season. Here with more, Vanessa Davis, Business Development Manager at the Ritz, and Stacey Aubrey. She's Director of Theaters for SMG. Ladies, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You know, we just celebrated 10 years of this show, Vanessa. The Ritz is celebrating 20 years, so congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're actually, the foundation is celebrating 90 years. It's been 90 years as the Ritz movie theater first in the Villa area.
Movie theater, live theater, and a museum, which I recommend everyone go visit. So, Stacey, what is on tap to celebrate the 20th?
Well, we have something going on all month long. We actually have jazz at the Ritz going on this Friday with a Christian Tambor, who's a vibraphonist. And then starting next weekend, we have a best of the best for our amateur night. The Ritz Theater has become known for its amateur night. And for the anniversary, we are bringing back a lot of the winners and people who were part of the founding of amateur night here in Jacksonville. And we also have a guest host for that night, we have somebody coming in from New York, Joe Gray, who's from the Apollo Theater, and he's going to host that night. And then on Saturday, September 21st, we have a tribute to Aretha Franklin, and we are bringing in Tony Award winner Melba Moore, and she's going to pay tribute to Aretha. And then we have some other fun
big names.
Yeah,
so a huge lineup for September. And Vanessa, the Ritz, if you've never been, people should go, because it is consistently booking amazing acts. And as Stacy said, the amateur night is so much fun.
It surely is. And we have a lot of series that go on throughout the year. So even if you're not able to catch us in September, please stop by another month. We'll be doing amateur night as well as our jazz series. But for the anniversary specifically, we'll also be celebrating on the 21st Museum Day. So if you are in the loop with the Smithsonian, please come out for Museum Day during the day and then come back for Melba Moore. And on the 19th, we have our Through Our Eyes exhibit opening, which is world-renowned and with a lot of local artists.
Yeah, I would really highly recommend that you go catch a show at the Ritz and then take some time to spend in the museum, where you will learn an incredible amount about this area's African-American history. Can't recommend it enough. Go to ritztheater.com for all of the lineup for September as the Ritz celebrates its 20th anniversary in Jacksonville. Vanessa Davis of the Ritz, Stacy Aubrey with SMG, Director of Theaters, doing an amazing job, both of you, programming this jewel of downtown Jacksonville. So enjoy the 20th, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests today and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. News director here is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. We always want your comments and feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, how new research links the impact of childhood trauma to Florida's opioid epidemic. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for some great music. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.